This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with Tom McCarthy. He is an environmental historian. He is associate professor in the history department at the U.S. Naval Academy. And he has authored a very interesting new book that takes a look at the history of the car in America, particularly looking at its environmental impact. Now, we think of that as being a very current contemporary concern, and it is. But one of the things that you discover when you look at his book, and the title is Automania, is that almost as long as there have been cars, even going back to the time when there weren't a lot of cars on the road and only very wealthy people could afford them, people were indeed concerned about the environmental impact of cars. The book Automania, Cars, Consumers, and the Environment is published by the Yale University Press. And as we talk with our guest, Tom McCarthy, questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in here, it's the same as always, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. No one will expect you to pledge. We, of course, hope that you will, but that's not required to call into the show. At any point here you want to join the conversation, you certainly are welcome to do that. And Professor McCarthy, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
I think that it's interesting, to me, I guess, it's interesting that for someone who is an historian, such a significant focus of this work is, in a sense, it's psychological. Because I think one of the strongest points you make, and when you think about getting people to change their attitudes or their habits when it comes to driving or buying cars, what you're really talking about is all of the things that cars do for people that don't have anything to do with transportation. And it seems like it's almost always been the case that cars, as people think about them and when they talked about how they felt about them, it was always more than just a thing to get you from one place to another.
Yeah, I think that's very true. When you think about it, automobiles are the most expensive, publicly used consumer products that are associated with ourselves. And so invariably, there had to be some sort of a presentational aspect to the vehicles that we buy and drive, an element of symbolic communication, where we're trying to express things about ourselves to larger communities that we're interested in gaining respect from.
That I do think that that's, again, it's really interesting that, maybe now we might, with the level of kind of consumerism that we have, you might criticize the car and you might criticize people for the way that they approach the car is something that says something about them. It's a statement about them. That it seems to be the case that, though, it's always been that way, a statement about them. For example, from the beginning, when only a few people could afford to have a car, there was this obsession with it, particularly with obsession with power and speed. And people who didn't drive cars, they really resented that. There was, I think, a very strong aspect of class conflict around the automobile.
Yeah, that's correct. Once the first Americans to buy automobiles bought them and got them out on the public roads, they were inevitably showing off. I think they were doing that consciously a lot of the time, but of course part of it was unconscious. And it was quite clear that these first automobile owners and drivers were having a hell of a good time doing things like speeding up and down clear roads when they could find them, or just getting out into the countryside to do a little exploring and to being seen. But of course, at the same time, people that didn't have automobiles were witnessing what was going on, and they too could see how exciting the new technology was. They could imagine themselves perhaps owning automobiles at some point in the future and indulging in these same pleasurable experiences. But at the same time, there was a real sense of envy, I think, among people who were not yet in a position financially to be able to afford automobiles. And I think some of that envy fueled some of the anger that non-automobile driving Americans had for the automobile in the early years. And in fact, when I went back and looked at the literature and the press in the early days of the automobile, that was one of the things that really, really amazed me. I have been not been prepared to well, for the strength of the emotions that I saw in press reports and what people were writing about their first reactions to the automobile.
Yeah.
Enthusiasm, anger, envy, all of those very, very present in the very first days.
There's here. There's a wonderful quote that I just loved here that just leaps off the page. This was from a speech that was given by Woodrow Wilson in 1906, at the time he was president of Princeton. And he said, "I think that of all the menaces of today, the worst is the reckless driving in automobiles." He says, "In this, the rights of the people are set at naught. When a child is run over, the automobilist doesn't stop, but runs away. Does the father of that child consider him heartless? I don't blame him if he gets a gun. I am a Southerner and know how to shoot. Would you blame me if I did so under such circumstances?" He went on to say, "Nothing has spread socialistic feeling in this country more than the use of automobiles."
Yeah, and I think that was typical of some of the angry reaction on the part of non-driving Americans to some of the things that these young men who were driving the early automobiles were doing on the public roads. I mean, the greatest thrill that they had was simply speeding.
Mm-hmm.
That was the fun that they had. But unfortunately, they were sharing the public roads with a lot of people who were not in automobiles, people who were still driving horse and buggies, people who were walking. And, of course, that led to automobile accidents involving pedestrians and other slower-moving vehicles and things like that. So, yes, naturally there was a reaction on the part of the public, and that reaction was sanctioned by spokespeople for the elites, so like Woodrow Wilson, president of Princeton at the time.
Yeah. It's interesting that given that level of feeling, and I suppose it does say something about the fact that people, maybe there was hostility towards cars and towards wealthy people who had them and the way that they drove. At the same time, as you suggest, when people looked, the people who didn't have cars, people who weren't that wealthy, looked at them, you wouldn't be surprised if in part they were thinking, I would like to have one of those. I wish I could be doing that. And so when it came time for when cars became affordable, and here the man that we either have to thank or curse, depending on how you feel about it, is Henry Ford, when he made it possible for middle-class people to have an automobile, that enormous numbers of people did that.
There's no way to really overestimate the importance of Henry Ford and what he did with introducing the Model T in 1908. But what I think is really interesting in what he did was not just make it possible for millions of Americans to own an automobile and close some of that status gap that had opened up between themselves and the very earliest automobile owners. I think the really neat thing that he did with the Model T was he produced a car that gave middle-class Americans a sense of self-respect. Okay, the Model T, we talk about it selling in millions because it was a low-priced car, and yes, eventually it did become very low-priced. But when it was introduced in 1908, it had just enough speed, just enough power, just enough cachet to allow Americans who couldn't afford the very expensive automobiles that the wealthy were driving to close a lot of that status gap without seeming to try to hypocritically ape the wealthier drivers. So there was just enough difference, but just enough similarity in the Model T. And I think Henry Ford, and he doesn't get enough credit for this, hit that right on the money when he designed the Model T. It was really an example of the perfect car for the perfect moment in psychological terms when it was introduced in 1908.
It's, again, one of the interesting things to me is that it seems that at least early on that people thought about the automobile, even people who had Model Ts, as a kind of a recreational vehicle. They didn't, as we do today, they weren't driving them to work. They weren't driving their kids to school. They weren't taking the car to go down to the grocery store. They weren't doing that. What they were doing with the car is essentially they were going for a drive on Sunday.
That's so true, and we forget that these days. The beginning of the 20th century, when Americans first started to play around with automobiles, we all had perfectly good ways to get to town, to get to work, to get to church, and do all the basic things we needed to do in our lives. And when the automobile came, it was really a recreational supplement. The only group that really differed from that, of course, were rural Americans. Had to deal with a lot of distances, getting from their farms into town to do the things that they needed. So no surprise that when cars like the Model T became available and became affordable, rural Americans who truly did have a real practical need to improve the quality of their personal transportation jumped on it pretty quickly. But you're absolutely right. For the rest of America, the automobile was very much a weekend recreational activity, truly a pleasure rather than a necessity. Mm-hmm. And for a good period of time, it really took us a large stretch of the 20th century to rebuild our environment in America around the assumption that just about all of us would have automobiles and could easily drive much larger distances between things like home and work, for example.
As you say, one of the advantages, or there, I suppose there were many advantages attached to the Model T, that it was an affordable vehicle, that it was adequately powered, that it was relatively easy to maintain and was not real complicated. It was reliable, that made that appealing to a lot of people.
Of the early races where the Model T was pitted against some of the larger, more expensive things, it actually won those races or did very well in those races. And those races got a lot of attention in the popular press. And so the impression that the Model T created in the minds of middle-class Americans was, well, here's not one of those flashy cars that the super wealthy are driving, but here's one that can hold its own and in some occasions actually do better than these wealthy cars. So again, it was just the perfect kind of vehicle for people who were feeling this sense of envy, this desire to close the status gap between the earliest automobile owners and themselves. Just got it right with the Model T.
Now, it was a mass-produced vehicle, however, and I think about that joke. I don't know if actually Henry Ford actually ever said it, that thing about how you can have any color you want as long as it's black.
Yeah, and it's not clear whether he ever actually said it, but it was certainly true about mass production of the Model Ts. And that was just a function of the fact that the fastest drying paint, in fact, the only paint for automobiles that would dry quickly enough to allow mass production was black. So that was a production issue.
How long was it before there was increasing popular demand from your sort of average consumer for, though, more variety, for people who wanted perhaps a different kind of vehicle, or they said, well, why can't I have a red one or a blue one, or why do they all have to look the same?
By about the middle of the 1920s, this would be after Ford had sold most of the 15 million Model Ts that it eventually sold while the car was on the market between 1908 and 1927. By the middle of the 20s, we think that maybe about 50% of American families owned vehicles at that point. And approximately half of the vehicles that Americans owned were versions of the Model T Ford. So after people had acquired their first automobiles, so many of them were Model Ts, a kind of obvious thing happened in the marketplace. People were looking for variety, a newer sort of vehicle, cars that came in different colors. And, of course, there was a change in automobile styling and technology in the middle of the 20s where closed vehicles came on the market, which literally meant that there was more car body to do more with in terms of shaping, color, to give consumers that variety that they wanted to have. And, of course, one of the great stories in automobile history is how the General Motors Corporation, led at the time by Alfred P. Sloan, began to study the marketplace, began to bend its own efforts to better accommodate this interest on the part of consumers for greater variety in vehicles. And that, of course, became one of the great 20th century American corporate success stories.
In this part of Focus 580, we're talking with Tom McCarthy. He's an environmental historian. He is an associate professor in the history department at the U.S. Naval Academy. And he's the author of a very interesting book, and certainly there is more in this book than we will have time to talk about here this morning. So you might want to go out and take a look at it. His title is Automania: Cars, Consumers, and the Environment. And it's published by the Yale University Press. And if you wouldn't mind just hanging on here, Professor McCarthy, for just a moment, what I want to do here is to take one more opportunity to remind people who are listening that this here now today and over the next couple of days is our fall membership campaign. That means that we are raising the money that will pay for programming in the fiscal year in which we find ourselves. It goes from now until the end of June. And we have set a goal for this drive, which is only 5 days, of $200,000. And we've got a good start. Last time I checked, I think we had about maybe $85,000, something like that. If you have been a listener to WILL for a long time or a short time, it doesn't matter. If this station's important to you, then your contributions are very important to us, your dollar contributions. So what you can do right now is help out by calling in a pledge. You can use our local number if you're in Champaign-Urbana. That is 244-9455. Or use the toll-free line, and that's 866-779-9455. Or 1-866-SPY-WILL. One way or another, your pledge is very important. We hope you'll do that right now. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me. He's our web guru. He is the producer emeritus of Focus 580.
That's right.
Continues to fill in as host from time to time here. And I'm real glad to have you here with me.
I'm proudest most of the producer emeritus title, actually, of Focus 580. So as far as we can predict, there will be news in the coming year. After all, the 2008 presidential campaign season has already started earlier than ever. And, of course, the last 2 years of George Bush's presidency will deal with issues surrounding the war in the Middle East and other things. But certainly that is a big issue we'll be hearing about on the news for some time. We're posed for some very interesting politics. Obviously, a Democratic Congress, a Republican president, an election coming up. Whether or not you are a political junkie, you can't help but be fascinated by events around this season. No matter how you cast your ballot in 2008, you better be informed because you've listened to WILL. We hope that you will and be informed. But that quality comes with a price, and that's why we're here today. Your call support has never been more important. Dial 244-9455 right now or toll-free 866-779-9455 or 866-FLY-WILL, huh? SPY-WILL.
SPY-WILL.
Oh, I'm mixing up with another famous local station. Make your contribution right now, and you can also go to willpledge.org.
Yeah, that's something that we have been doing more and more. We have been encouraging people to use the website. It's fast, it's secure, and I think that probably you can answer that question that over time lots of people have been responding that way through the website. So that's really not the important thing. Yes, we do want you to call, go online, you know, whichever works for you. But the thing we want you to consider is just how important you are to maintaining the character of WILO, keeping it the kind of place that it is. Now, there are radio stations that count on commercials for their income. That's the way they pay the bills. Think for a moment what it would be like if, for example, Focus 580 had commercials. I don't really think that I would want to be a host under those circumstances where I was having a conversation with somebody and it was just getting good, and then I'd have to say, oh, wait a minute, hold on, we have to go do some commercials and take a break. Well, we couldn't do the show in the way we do it if we had to have commercials. So it's great that most of our support comes from listeners, but that also means that if the listeners don't come across, then we're in big trouble. So that's what we want you to remember. You are very, very important to this station, not just as a listener, not just as somebody who calls, but also as a financial supporter. You pay the bills to keep the station here. This is one of those times, and we've tried the best we can to shorten it up It's one of those times that we come right here in front of the microphone and say, look, we couldn't do it without you. Now's the time to make a pledge. So again, 244-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Go online. Go willpledge.org. Either way, your contributions are real important. We hope you'll do that right now. And we'll get back to Jack here and talk a little bit again near the end of the hour. And right now, of course, we want to get back to our guest. And we do, in fact, have some callers who are calling in. And we will give you the opportunity to talk with our guest once again. Our guest is Tom McCarthy, and he is associate professor of history, U.S. Naval Academy. His book is Automania, Cars, Consumers, and the Environment. So let us get back here to some callers, and we'll talk with someone in Centralia. They're calling on a cell phone. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting. Don't know how good the connection is, so I'll make it short. Wondering if the guest could speak on two topics. Number one, the development of the gas station. And I'm thinking here about Standard Oil and Rockefeller development at the same time, almost the same time as the car. And then also was wondering if World War One played any role in the development of the truck for the American economy. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
All right. Can you do that, Professor McCarthy?
On the first one, yes. One of the big concerns that observers of the new automobile industry had right at the beginning of the 20th century was the fact that the internal combustion engine was using gasoline as its fuel. And one of the specific concerns that those observers had was the fact that gasoline in the United States at the time was monopolized by the Standard Oil Company. And so there was a great movement around 1905, 1906, 1907 to remove an excise tax, a $2 excise tax that had been placed by the federal government on ethyl alcohol, going back to the Civil War, which made ethyl alcohol very, very expensive. But these observers worried about the gasoline supply and the fact that it was in the hands of the Standard Oil monopoly, argued that if you could take the excise tax off ethyl alcohol, that the price of it might come down far enough to make it competitive with gasoline, and therefore would liberate this new industry that had the prospects of becoming a very major mass industry over time from its dependence on gasoline. Now, that didn't happen. Unfortunately, the marketplace, automakers, and consumers were too committed to gasoline-powered internal combustion engines by 1907 when the excise tax finally came off. For a number of other reasons, the price of ethyl alcohol didn't fall far enough or fast enough to make it an attractive alternative. Not sure when the first gas stations became available, but certainly it was in the by the teens. There were gas stations throughout the country catering to motorist needs, although for the first decade it was actually fairly tough to find gasoline everywhere. But one of the advantages that Standard Oil had was because at the beginning of the automobile era, it was in the business of providing kerosene to Americans primarily for illumination purposes. It already had a nationwide distribution system, primarily through retail outlets like country stores and things like that. And those were the first places that began to sell gasoline. And I guess part of the process was that a number of those stores simply evolved into the first gas stations. Hmm. Second question. Not sure about trucks. That's not something I looked at directly in the research for the book. But trucks, I think, did become much, much more prevalent and useful around the time of the First World War. There were, of course, vehicles being adapted for truck-like purposes, commercial purposes, even before the First World War. But again, that's not something I'd looked at.
Yeah. Just to also, one of the things I think that's really interesting in this story is the fact that, you know, now we are concerned about our reliance on oil because it's a finite resource. It's not renewable.
Right.
And that is driving a lot of the interest in alternative fuels to power internal combustion engines. What's really striking is that from the very start, even as far back as the turn of the last century, people were talking about the problem of gasoline. That is, it was non-renewable resource. And we're raising this question, would it be possible in the future to meet an expected growing demand for gasoline? And at the time, I think a lot of people said, well, really the best solution to that is to not use gasoline and instead to use alcohol.
Very true. I mean, ethyl alcohol really from the very beginning has been the most attractive alternative fuel source. If you want to hold on to the basic technology of the internal combustion engine, if you're looking for the easier technological migration path from gasoline to another fuel source, I mean, alcohol was always the agreed-upon best direction to go. And in concurrence with these periodic worries about the adequacy of petroleum reserves and the gasoline supply, which have recurred with frequency across the 20th century, at the time of World War One, again in the early 20s, the end of the 1930s, as many of us remember, in the 1970s, and then again in recent years, almost invariably brings up this question, why not alcohol? Mm-hmm. So yes, always been the major alternative.
All right, let's talk with someone in Chicago next, line one. Hello.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Follow up on the matter of alcohol and gasoline or oil was a meeting between Buckminster Fuller and Rockefeller, I understand, regarding this particular vehicle that Buckminster had developed. And Bucky said this car, he had hoped it would be run on alcohol, and Rockefeller said, no, it's going to be run on oil, and the deal never became consummated, I understand. Did you know anything about that?
No, I've never heard that story.
Yeah.
No.
Something I've heard a number of times.
Very interesting.
And regarding the alcohol situation, I understand in South America, of course, they realized the oil dilemma way back then, and when the prices skyrocketed during the 70s there, that they had to find an alternative. And they chose to develop alcohol. And, of course, that's the main fuel down there, I understand. Of course, everybody seems to have a hangover, so all the alcohol fumes. But going back to Ford's development of the automobile, the one environmental impact was he developed a community for the workers upon which they thrived and found a very compatible relationship between the production facilities and the community that Ford had developed for the workers to live in. And that became very, very, very accommodating. But today, of course, with automation, we now see no people, therefore no concern for the workers, and in terms of environmental displacement, we now have workers languishing without jobs and so forth as a result of automation and displacement of workers. So I'll call and give you that contribution. Thank you.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Well, you want to follow up on any of that in particular?
No, not specifically.
Okay. Well, let me ask you something. Talk about something a little bit different, particularly because the main focus of the book is environmental impact. We talking just a moment ago about how what seems to be a contemporary concern about the use of finite fossil fuels, it goes in fact back to the beginning. It is also the case that virtually back to the beginning, to the time when there weren't really all that many cars on the road, that there was also concern about pollution in the sense of tailpipe emissions.
Yep. Yep.
You know, people were right from the very beginning, people were complaining about auto exhaust.
That's right, and that was very much an issue with the smoky nature of that automobile exhaust. But very, very quickly, scientists and engineers began asking the more or less obvious question, is this smoke detrimental to human health or to plants and things like that, and began doing some investigation on that. Of course, one of the things they discovered was that carbon monoxide was poisonous in confined spaces and things like that. But that really put them on to a deeper finding that would be important in this whole emissions science. And that is the fact that complete combustion was not taking place in these internal combustion engines. If the mixture of air and gasoline had been combusting completely, the only byproducts would have been water and carbon dioxide, which, of course, were considered then benign byproducts. But it was quite clear that that was not happening, so some other substances were coming out of the tailpipe, which began the whole science of looking at the emissions. But yeah, early on, the problem with smoking exhaust was upsetting to a lot of people, especially in urban areas where you began to have greater concentrations of automobiles. One of the places where people started complaining about smoking automobiles was Central Park, which, of course, had been built right smack in the middle of New York City to give people a chance to get away from the nature of urban life, to get back to nature. And once automobile drivers began driving through Central Park, emitting exhaust as they went, a lot of people started to complain about that. So the city passed an ordinance at first that applied to driving in the park, that allowed the park police to throw cars out of the park that were giving off too much exhaust. So even an attempt back in about the same time, 1908-1910, to extend that ordinance to the city at large, they did adopt that ordinance, and they did try to enforce it sporadically for a couple of years, but it just proved to be too overwhelming for the police department to try and stop every automobile that was smoking. But the other interesting thing is that scientists have begun to observe impacts of automobile exhaust, especially on plant life. And later in the 20th century, we'd recognize that that was a consequence of ozone smog formation that was having that effect. So scientists were onto this early, although it really wasn't until the middle of the 20th century with the work of Ari Hagen-Schmidt at Caltech, that the science that linked automobile exhaust to the formation of smog was really worked out in a satisfactory way.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener, someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Does your book touch on the impact of the hybrid car and what they're going to do with all those batteries in the next decade or so? And my other question is going to be, I see Mercedes-Benz running an ad on they have a hydrogen car when the world is ready. I mean, what's the progress of that?
Well, my book is essentially history, so I don't touch really on the prospects of hybrid cars and or what's going to happen with the batteries from electric vehicles or things like that, although a lot of people out there have noted that there certainly are disposal environmental issues associated with that. And I'm sorry, the second part of your question?
Was about the potential for hydrogen, I guess, you know, a fuel cell hydrogen fuel cell, I guess, powering the car.
I don't talk about that too much, again, because the book is retrospective. It's a history, although I do talk a little bit about a recent conversation that is in this decade, looking at the alternatives that are out there. And there's no question that in this most recent go-around on alternatives to the gasoline-powered internal combustion engine, a lot of people have been talking about hydrogen fuel cells as really the preferred alternative. I was going to say in the intermediate term, maybe I should say in the long term, because it still seems that it's a little bit down the road. Although there have been prototype vehicles that actually some of the manufacturers have let consumers play around with a little bit. The problem is that they're, to my understanding, they're still extremely expensive to make. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there needs to be some sort of a distribution system in place for the hydrogen fuel for hydrogen-powered vehicles to become an option for most Americans. It seems to me it's still well down the road.
Certainly, the idea of an electric car is not new. There have, in the history of the automobile, long before now, there have been electric cars.
Right back to the beginning.
How did people think about that, and did that ever seem to be obviously there are technological limitations, there are environmental limitations, there are a lot of issues here associated with an electric car. But was it something
The big problem with electrics, of course, was the battery life. the fact that it limited the range of the vehicle. Once the battery charge went down, you'd have to stop wherever you were and get a recharge. Now, there were attempts made early on in the East Coast to set up a series of recharging stations. So, for example, you could get from Philadelphia to New York. You know, you would just kind of time your drive so you made sure that you stopped at these stations when you needed to. But that was a lot more. That demanded a lot more of an electric vehicle owner. There were also gender differences. Many of the early owners of electric vehicles were women, or their husbands bought their wives electric vehicles. And there was a more of a masculine association with the internal combustion engine and greater sense of adventure and danger associated with internal combustion engine vehicles. And I think that worked to the advantage of gasoline-powered cars and to the disadvantage of the electric-powered vehicles.
Yeah. Were there points at which car manufacturers really said, you know, we have in the American woman, we have here a serious untapped market, and that if we develop the right kind of market, the right kind of marketing strategy and the right kind of product, that we could sell even more cars because we would have more women buying cars for themselves?
Yeah, I think that the short answer is that it has been a continuing interest almost from the beginning. There was so much symbolic cachet associated with automobile ownership that it was inevitable that pretty much everyone in a family would want to jump into the decision about what type of vehicle to purchase. So the automobile literature, and here I'm talking about the automobile press, people actually following the behavior of consumers, constantly, from the beginning, talking about the role of women in making these decisions. And, of course, later on, when American families have more wealth and can begin thinking about having more than one car for the household, and then begin to tailor their marketing efforts towards individuals and different market segments, there will be a little bit more advertising tailored directly at women.
We're very quickly, unfortunately, coming to the end of our time. Maybe we have about 5 minutes left. And again, I want to tell people that there's a lot of very interesting history in this book. So you might well want to take a look at it, the book Automania by our guest Tom McCarthy. It's published by the Yale University Press. Something that maybe we might finish up on is the power of the consumer to determine what kind of cars are available. And I think that now certainly there's a lot of attention focused on the environmental impact of the car and what kind of car would be good for the environment. And we put a lot of the onus on the car manufacturers as if to say, well, what we're expecting you to do is do the right thing and build the right kind of car. That's all well and good, but if people don't buy them, they're not going to be a success. The car companies aren't going to do well, and neither will the environment. Something that I think it's really an important point is that people say certain things, but then what they do, that's something completely different. And how that has played out, you know, how consumer desire has played out all through the history of the automobile in this country.
Yeah, there's absolutely no question about it. Consumers, either as individuals or collectively, have the power to significantly influence the types of vehicles that the automakers offer. I mean, it's just basic. Consumers did not buy the vehicles that were being offered. The automakers would quickly change the vehicles that they offer. And we've seen that a couple times in the history of the automobile in America. We saw in the late 50s, when a significant number of consumers began to decamp from the large, high-powered, tail-finned automobiles of the big three for alternatives like the Volkswagen Beetle, the AMC Rambler, and they responded with the compact cars, the Falcon, the Corvair, Plymouth Valiant, and things like that, again in the 1970s when there was a shift to smaller vehicles. So there's no question that consumers have this power, but what I would argue, what I argue in the book, is that this power, more often than not, is a kind of latent power. It's really not brought to bear in a focused way in the automobile market, and that's because consumers have other interests in automobiles simply than choosing the types of vehicles that have the least amount of impact on the environment. Sure, it'd be great if they moved environmental concern to the very top of their agenda, but their agendas are rich in other things that are very, very important to them in making their vehicle choices. And the real story, I think, of the history of the relationship between American automobile consumers and American automobile makers is that they have found ground, common ground with one another, as buyers and sellers, in vehicles that more often than not have not been very environmentally friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Although fortunately, thanks to the Clean Air Act in 1970 and the government finally stepping in, we were able to address problems like emissions with the catalytic converter and really clean up tailpipe emissions significantly. So while it's been difficult for consumers and producers on their own to produce environmentally friendly vehicles, we have nonetheless, with great difficulty, made some progress, and that's an important part of the story that I try to tell.
But it also sounds as if what you're saying is that if we as a society decide that it would be a good thing for us to switch to vehicles that are perhaps smaller, pollute less, use less gasoline, that we cannot expect most consumers to make that switch because it's the right thing to do and it will give them a warm feeling, that somehow or another there have to be incentives, either incentives to buy the kind of vehicles that we're talking about or disincentives to discourage people from buying other kinds of vehicles, that people won't just do it because we think that it's a good idea.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Absent some serious crisis, some personal threat, from environmental impact involving automobiles, I think it's too much to ask consumers en masse to move environmental impact to the top of their agendas when buying vehicles. That really is too much to ask. On the other hand, I don't think it's too much to ask of the automakers that they do more to design vehicles as well as redesign manufacturing processes with an eye towards minimizing to a greater degree than they already have the impact of their processes and their vehicles. I think there's still a lot that can be done there. And I think a great example of it is the way that Toyota has been pushing hybrids over the last 10 years. Not forced to do it by regulation, but they see a societal need there to produce vehicles that use less gasoline, therefore produce less carbon dioxide, and they've taken it upon themselves as a corporation to bring those vehicles to market and stand behind them, and if you listen to their pronouncements, to make them a larger percentage of the vehicles that they sell around the world.
Yeah.
So it really is a lot more that the automakers could do on their own. And, of course, the more the automakers do on their own, the less we have to think about things like turning to regulation to force them to do it.
All right. Well, if people listening to us are interested in reading a good, concise history of the car in America with this kind of environmental emphasis, the book to look for is Automania: Cars, Consumers, and the Environment. It's recently been published by the Yale University Press by our guest Tom McCarthy. He is associate professor in the history department at the U.S. Naval Academy. And Professor McCarthy, thank you very much.
David, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.